between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the honor of being joined by Dr. Kathy Cripps. Dr. Cripps is a mycologist and professor at Montana State University, where she teaches and does research on fungi. She earned her BS from the University of Michigan and PhD from Virginia Tech with Dr. Orson Miller. Her research on mushrooms that survive in Arctic and Alpine habitats has taken her to Iceland, Svalbard, Norway, Greenland, the Austrian Alps, and Finland. She is co-author of The Essential Guide to Rocky Mountain Mushrooms by Habitat and Fungi in Forest Ecosystems, and has authored numerous scientific papers. She is also involved with using mycorrhizal fungi in the restoration of white bark pine forests. With over 40 years of experience collecting mushrooms, first as an amateur when she lived in a cabin in Colorado, and later as a professional leading forays and teaching field classes in Montana, her love and enthusiasm for the Rocky Mountains and its fungal creatures runs deep. Dr. Cripps, Kathy, thank you so much for coming on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, definitely not as excited as I am to have you. You've been a guest that has been referenced by numerous guests I've had on, whether it be Todd Osmondson, who, yes, you infamously found in a mall, or foragers out in Colorado in the Rocky Mountain region who use your books as kind of the Bible of fungal diversity. So it is an absolute honor to have you on. And we're going to talk about some fascinating fungal systematics and habitats of the Rocky Mountains. But before we dive into it, I am curious into what got you into exploring the natural sciences and then having this fascination with kingdom fungi.
Yes. Well, I can tell you that I had a naturalist bent early on, and I grew up in Michigan, fishing the lakes in Michigan. I remember rowing out in a boat, pulling up various fish. It was my first exercise in taxonomy, pulling in fish and going, is it a bluegill? Is it a sunfish? Is it a perch? So that was taxonomic right off the bat. And then I had a fascination with pond life and pond scum, for one, algae, and the small little crustaceans that swim around the edges of ponds. So early on, it was aquatic systems, and that led me into a really strong interest in marine biology, oceans, creatures of the benthic deep. Mm. They really fascinated me. So early on, I was not headed for the mountains and mushrooms. I was headed for the ocean and the bottom of the ocean.
Which I think everyone at some point has had a fascination with the ocean and the vast unknown. So, you know, if that's something you're interested in, is this wildly alien landscape of the ocean floor, it's kind of not too far a stretch to see you become obsessed with this enigmatic kingdom of life that is fungi.
I think you're absolutely right, because if you look at some of the creatures in the tide pools or the ocean bottom, interesting, a lot of them have what's called radial symmetry. Hmm. You can divide them in any which way and still get two halves, versus lateral symmetry, which is us. You can only divide us one way and get two equal halves. There's something about radial symmetry in the ocean creatures and fungi and mushrooms that has really grabbed me.
I've never thought of that, but maybe that has something to do with their aesthetic appeal. It's radial symmetry. I love that.
That's right. And then you asked why did I switch?
Yeah.
why the oceans and going from them to the mountains? Well, I graduated from college and I headed to Colorado to visit some friends in the high mountains of southwestern Colorado. And the mountains grabbed me. The peaks and the valleys, the snow, everything about the mountains really grabbed me. So I ended up living there for the next 18 years. I was home.
Wow.
I was home. And after living there, I lived in a couple different cabins. I was subsistence living, no electricity, no running water for that time. The first cabin I lived in, I was snowed in 6 months of the year. Really peaceful living.
Talk about off-grid, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely off-grid. And the subsistence living was elk, venison, berries, wild plants. The next actual extension of that would be wild mushrooms.
Of course, foraging for survival. I mean, at this point, were you doing academic research or were you just a wild human out in the mountains hunting and gathering?
I was a wild human. I became perhaps a little bit feral, I've been told at the time. I was getting away from academics. I was taking a break. I was taking an 18-year break between undergrad and graduate school. And so I spent the next 18 years running around collecting mushrooms in the woods and figuring out which ones can you eat. There's a small town about 7 miles down valley, and there were a lot of European immigrants there, and they knew which mushrooms to eat. So I learned from them some of the first ones, the king boletes and the chanterelles. Those are the mushrooms that they were picking. So I learned from them.
Probably one of the best sources out there of people whose society and culture has been interacting with mushrooms for generations and generations and generations. So, I mean, what then pulled you back to civilization after 18 years? What was the impetus to go back into academia and get on the path of research you're on today? Because, I mean, it sounds like that scenario is kind of idyllic, and I think what a lot of people want now. So I'm surprised you didn't just kind of disappear into the mountains for good. What pulled you back?
Right. Well, it was a long, slow pull to pull me out of the mountains, because you're right. I was perfectly happy running around collecting mushrooms, and it was rather idyllic. Yes, skiing in the winter, mushroom hunting in the summer. Over the years, I just started learning more and more, and it went beyond wanting to know what was edible and what was not. Suddenly, it was the biodiversity of the mushrooms. There was this kind. What is this? What is that? What is that? What are the names of all these? And really, there were no good field guides at that time. There were some of the old field guides, no photos, certainly no color photos, maybe a black and white photo, but often just descriptions. So not much to go by there. I learned a few more with those black and white field guides, but then, as luck would have it, a really eclectic mushroom group showed up over the ridge from my cabin, and they were looking for a place to hold a mushroom festival.
Ah.
This group was going to eventually be the Telluride Mushroom Festival, but the very first festival was in Gothic, Colorado, which is the Rocky Mountain Biological Station, and it was right over the ridge from my cabin. So I hiked over there to see what was going on, and there was Gary Linkoff, Paul Stamets, Andrew Weil, Manny Salzman, Linnea Gilman, all these crazy mycologists right there in my woods. And they knew the names of the mushrooms that I wanted to learn. So it was serendipity all the way. There they were.
I mean, just a mind-blowing part of kind of mycophilia lore here in the States. And I guess you being kind of out in the wild for 18 years, did you have a familiarity with any of the mycologists there? Were those some of the field guides you have been reading, whether it be Gary Linkoff's, maybe Audubon Society guide, or did you have any familiarity on the group you just stumbled onto?
I had no familiarity, zero. And Gary had not written his Audubon guide yet.
Oh, of course.
So this is going way back. So no Audubon guide. I did not know these people at all. But I can tell you, when I go into a room and one of them would give a talk, I just suddenly realized I'd found my tribe.
You found
this
your tribe.
This was my tribe.
Yes.
This was my tribe. They had funny hats like I did. They carried a basket. They walked around looking down in the woods. It was my tribe. So it was a serendipity. And after that, I went to all of the Telluride mushroom festivals for the next, oh, maybe 8 or 9 years. I was the recorder there. And so it started to bring me out of the woods a little bit. Gary Linkoff always had a good laugh. He calls it my nonverbal stage. I was not very verbal. I didn't speak. And when I did, if I tried to say a Latin name, Gary laughed even harder because I had my own woods pronunciation. And I'd never heard any of those names before. I knew the mushrooms, but I didn't know how to pronounce them. So he had a good laugh over that.
So it's funny to think of kind of the mushroom tribe or the mycologist tribe as like civilizing you and bring you back into the fold. Cause I think so many people see mushroom people as so out there. And for you, it was like this stabilizing, civilizing force, which is really interesting. Well, what a vivid, fascinating story that I had no idea. You're kind of intertwined at the heart of mycophilic culture here in the United States then.
Yes, it started way back in those characters, Gary Linkoff, Paul Stamets. I tell you, they were just the same back then as they are now. And I think it really helped me to hook up with this kind of eclectic mycologist, as you say, on the fringe, rather than the academic mycologist right away.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what would have happened there. So they were sort of the gateway into mycology.
As they are for so many people. I guess then what pulled you into the academic sphere? Because now, obviously, you've written scientific papers, you've written books, you teach at a university. So what kind of pushed you in that direction, you know, from being amateur, maybe expert forager into academic researcher?
After years of collecting, I decided I wanted to take a mushroom course. And I looked around for what mushroom courses were available and found out that Dr. Orson Miller had a wonderful mushroom identification course that he taught at Flathead Lake in Montana. So I signed up for that course and probably shouldn't say this now, but hitchhiked on up there. People hitchhiked back then. It was a different world. And I took his course and I was even more fascinated. Orson is such an excellent teacher. He has a lot of students now that could attest to that. He was a visual teacher. He put up diagrams. He was organized. Back then, it was only a slide projector. So after the lecture, he'd give us a few Kodachrome slides and take us on field trips. Oh, excellent teacher. And all that information I wanted to know was just being absorbed into my brain. And at the end of the course, he asked me, would you like to be one of my graduate students? And I said, no, I'm going back to the woods.
Of course.
I said, that was not on my mind. I just wanted to learn the mushrooms, go back to the woods. I was fine. After a couple years of being back in the woods, I started thinking, well, you know, the woods, there's a sameness, same seasons over and over. You get ready for winter, you get the wood in, you get the mushrooms in, you get the elk in, and then you have winter and you start over. And I thought, well, why not try it? I can always come back. So that was my safety valve, that I could return to the woods.
You have the cyclical nature of your mountainous woods that aren't going to change. You can always run back, go back to the cabin if you need to.
That's right. You can always hightail it back and live the same way. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try a little bout out into civilization. And so I followed Orson to graduate school at Virginia Polytech. I had to go east, which was a big deal.
Huge
for
move.
Me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's at least near the Blue Ridge Mountains and all of that. But yeah, I thought, okay, I'll get a master's degree, couple years, learn the mushrooms, go back to the woods. I was there for 7 years and got a PhD.
And what was your PhD in, or what did you focus on during that time?
That was mycorrhizal fungi in aspen forest. Because if I studied aspen forest, the big ones were in the west, and I had to go back to the Rocky Mountains every summer to study those forests. So
I see your strategy now. Very carefully crafted academic course. Well, and I guess when you entered this academic sphere, did you understand the biology of mycorrhizal fungi? Was this something that you were most fascinated with? Or when did those come into focus as the most, or one of the most kind of incredible parts of what fungi do biologically and the niches they fill as these mycorrhizal kind of networks of the forest?
Well, Orson's lab was really well known for mycorrhizal work. And so he had a history of students that had done some kind of research on mycorrhizal fungi. He had done a lot. And when I heard the concept, I did not know why some of those mushrooms I was picking that were edible mushrooms were where they were, that they were in certain kinds of conifer forests or in aspen forests. Now I knew, because they were connected to the tree roots, and they were connected to certain kinds of tree roots. And a light bulb went off in my head. And I'm not sure I've gotten past that first question of what's where as far as mycorrhizal fungi are concerned.
Yeah, well, that's many lifetimes probably of research to just figure out what's where, much less the why and any kind of applied use. You know, so much of that question still is the what's where. Now, you know, we've gone over mycorrhizal fungi on the show before, some of the basics of the biology. So what kind of mycorrhizal fungi was your focus? Was it just kind of everything and gradually changed, or what set of mycorrhizal fungi did you focus in on?
For me, it was always ectomycorrhizal fungi. And ecto simply means outside. And that simply means that the mycelium actually connects up to the outside of tree roots. It covers them like a little sock. And then there's an intimate exchange. The fungus is feeding on the carbon from the tree, and the mycelium of the fungus brings nutrients back to the plant, usually nitrogen for the ectomycorrhizal fungi. But the main reason ectomycorrhizal fungi were it is because they were connected to trees, forests. Brings me back to my roots, literally, yeah. I guess.
Brings you back to the roots, inevitably. Well, and then what is unique about the alpine? Because in reviewing a lot of your research, of course, as we've heard your story, it's no surprise you went to focus on mountainous ecosystems. So then what is unique about that ectomycorrhizal scene in mountainous or alpine regions? And maybe we have to start with defining, you know, on the tiers of elevation, or what is alpine?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea because alpine can be defined two ways. And a lot of people, when they hear alpine mushrooms, simply think of mushrooms that are in the mountains.
Right.
But it's more specific than that. The alpine, the true alpine, is the landscapes above tree line. So if you're walking on a trail through the mountains and you're going up through the forest to higher and higher and higher elevations, all of a sudden the trees stop, the forests stop, and in front of you is this whole open landscape, tundra-like landscape of low vegetation, no trees. And that's what I would define as the true alpine, above tree line on high mountain tops.
Well, we just talked about how ectomycorrhizal fungi are the networkers of trees and forests. So if you're saying we're going above the tree line, what kind of forest are we looking at that could even host ectomycorrhizal fungi?
Kind of interesting, isn't it? People are saying, well, if you study mycorrhizal fungi and there aren't any trees,
Feels like we're missing a critical element. Yeah.
yes, we are. And I was for years. I walked right over the miniature forests of the Alpine when I was trucking around the mountains and those high elevations. I was never really looking for edible mushrooms above tree line. I was not looking for forests. You get up there and you have to look straight down at your feet. The forests in the Alpine are tiny, tiny willows, 1 inch high, and they make huge mats across the alpine. They could be a couple feet wide, 10 feet, 100 feet wide, but they're only an inch high. They are true willows. They're called dwarf willows, and they are mycorrhizal. They are ectomycorrhizal. That's where you find the ectomycorrhizal fungi.
That is mind-blowing. Dwarf willows, 1 inch tall willow trees were the host that you're studying. And then what kind of mycorrhizal networks are they hosts to? I mean, it's hard to imagine a big porcini or a big amanita partnering with this tiny tree, but I guess the size wouldn't necessarily matter. But
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the alpine mushrooms are small. Are tiny, which I can talk about in a minute. Some of them are pretty good size. There are a few Amanitas up there that are the typical size for an Amanita, at the size of your hand. They tower over the mycorrhizal forests. So instead of having the tall trees with the mushrooms below them, now you have the tiny trees with the mushrooms towering over the forest. Fungi win on this one.
It's an amazing landscape to envision, definitely.
Sometimes when you're walking around and you really have to look down in this environment and you're looking through those dwarf willows, it's almost like you're in a plane, looking down and zooming over them. It's an aerial view of the forest.
Right. I think everyone at one time or another who loves mushrooms has had a dream of a forest made of towering mushrooms. And so you kind of
Yes,
get that effect.
you do. And if you lay on your stomach and you get close to the ground where it's warmer and you get a side view, you can see the mushrooms towering over those trees. And it's really interesting. You'll be wandering around, and the alpine is rather a mosaic, a patchwork of vegetation. So you learn how to pick out the dwarf willow patches from a distance. They're a certain color, they're at a certain wetness, and when you find those, you just get on your belly and look around for tiny little mushrooms in the willow forest. It's a miniature world.
The question that, of course, comes to mind is how diverse of hosts are these dwarf willows? How vibrant of an ectomycorrhizal community are they cultivating? Because you said Amanita, what are some other players in those ecosystems?
Well, it's interesting because it's actually reasonably diverse. You have a lot of the typical mycorrhizal groups, Amanita, Heboloma, Inosibi, Cortinarius, Russula, Lactarius. Most of them are gilled ectomycorrhizal fungi, and not so much the non-gilled, such as the tooth fungi or the chanterelles, for example. So we have a lot of different gilled, but the species are different from the ones that you would find at lower elevation. And a lot of times the mushrooms are much smaller.
Interesting. So they actually have done their own speciation up there. And that, of course, leads to the question of when you first discovered these dwarf willow forests, what were some of your biggest questions or some of the questions that you were looking into in your research?
Well, it's interesting. When I first got started, there was another one of those forays, a NAMA foray in Colorado, and Orson Miller was leading a foray up into the Alpine on Loveland Pass. And we went up there, and he had collected in Alaska, and he started showing us where to look for the mushrooms, because you could walk right over them. You would never even know that they were there. And I was like, whoa, they are there. They're hidden under the willows. They're over the willows. You just have to know where to look. So I was really excited. And then right after that foray, Meinhard Moser from Austria, who's a very well-known mycologist, and Egon Horak, also known as Sporax, another well-known mycologist from Austria, were headed up to Niwot Ridge, which is high elevation in Colorado, 12, 13,000 feet. And I followed them up there. They taught me more about the willows and the mushrooms. I was just simply fascinated. And willows are related to aspen. Wow. They're in the same family. So did they have the same species? If the host plant's related, or were they going to be totally different? They were going to be totally different.
They ended up being totally different. That's fascinating, because you said some of your earliest work was on aspens. So in relation to these alpine dwarf willow forests, are aspens occurring at similar elevations? Or where does the aspen forest, with apparently its own unique host of ectomycorrhizal players, where is that fitting into this picture?
So the aspen forests are in what it would be called the subalpine.
Okay.
So you have a tree line, above that's alpine, below that tree line would be aspen. And that would be, you might have conifers at tree line or in the subalpine interspersed with aspen forests, but it would be all below tree line. So they do not overlap. You do not find aspen in the alpine.
Interesting. That's a good delineation, including for myself, who had kind of lumped all of these things together. And another thing that's apparent in your work is, you know, this idea that yes, host trees play a role in what kind of mycorrhizal communities we're forming. But what are some other factors? And, you know, were there maybe other factors involved in terms of where ectomycorrhizal fungi like to live, like soil conditions and things like that, that may explain why when you go into the alpine, even in related trees, you get different ectomycorrhizal fungi than in the subalpine aspen forest? What are some of those other factors?
Yeah, so that first filter appears to be host, but then climate plays into this, because some of the hosts might have a wide range, and certain fungi can only live in particular climates. And then you get down to soil type. Soil type really fascinated me for a while. When I was just learning about aspen forests, I picked three different aspen forests, each with a different soil type. Mm. And what I wanted to know is, will the mycorrhizal fungi be the same, or will they be different in each of those soil types? And like a lot of research questions, it's complicated, but there was a lot of overlap for some of the forests, for some of the mushrooms, but there were also particular groups that were only found on one site or another site. And one of the special sites was a site near Butte, Montana, that had been acidified by smelters. So the pH went down as low as 4. So this is really, really acidic.
Yeah.
And I found a unique set of fungi that could survive in that acidic soil that I did not find on any of the other sites. Thalephora, Paxillus, Inosibilacera, some of the Licarias, they could survive on that acidic soil. And then I realized, I read this book on fungi that are coming in on coal spoils in Pennsylvania. That's really an extreme environment. A lot of those were the same species that I was finding in the smelter impacted site. So soil can be a big difference. Another one would be tree age, I discovered. Now, aspen forests are also very different because it's not single trees in an aspen forest. All those trees are springing from the same root system. It's all one gigantic
organism. It's so hard to believe. It's one huge organism. Yeah.
Maybe the world's largest organism.
Right.
There was a contest a few years back. What's larger? Which aspen forest is the largest? I think Pando might have it in Utah right now. It's called Pando. There's also the largest fungus. Is it a honey mushroom, an armillaria? And all this is going back and forth. Which is bigger? So when you go into an aspen forest, it's not individual trees. It's one tree. And that's just sprouting. And then think about all the different mycorrhizal fungi hanging off the roots, all those different species. And then it might be in one type of soil or another type of soil. But for me, it was the age of the tree or the age of the clone, however you want to look at it.
Right.
There are some mycorrhizal fungi that come in early, right away on young trees, and they're called early colonizers. And then as the tree ages, and maybe if it's an aspen forest, the leaves fall, they decay, the interior of the forest becomes more conducive to other species. And now you have a whole diversity of mycorrhizal fungi coming in. And then eventually somebody wins. Mm. So the mycorrhizal fungi that are really good competitors kind of take over. And that's eventually what will happen in the older aspen stands. Diversity goes down and the winners take their throne. So it's called a succession of mycorrhizal fungi. So that also fascinated me.
I mean, it's incredibly fascinating to think about some kind of fungal succession, because we all know about forest succession, I think most people are familiar with. So to think, of course, that would be happening on the fungal level. And it's also funny to think about competition in the context of a fungi who, I think for most people, whose very nature symbolizes cooperation and, you know, how the forest, these organisms work together. But those mycorrhizal fungi are all competing for a foothold. And yeah, some end up being able to survive in kind of sandier soils or more acidic soils. And that's where they catch their foothold. So there's still a competitive landscape at play. And I've always been convinced that tree age must have something to do with ectomycorrhizal fungi and where they show up. Now, in your research, is that something unique to aspens in terms of clone age affecting those populations? Or do you think that finding kind of extrapolates out to other forests, where yes, tree age has a big role? And maybe we could ask that for all these different conditions in other forests.
That's right. And it extrapolates to all the different forests. And I first learned that running around Colorado, collecting my edible mushrooms. And it was on a site outside Crested Butte, Colorado, on a ridge that had been logged by the miners. And then the trees came back. Mm. And they were a lot of even age trees. That's where the chanterelles were. So if you went to a certain age forest and you wanted chanterelles, that's where you looked. So I learned succession by looking for edible mushrooms first. But yes, it translates across to all different types of forests.
So we really need to start paying attention to the tree ages. For all of you foragers out there, for edible mycorrhizal mushrooms, we need to start keying into the age of the forest as a pretty crucial factor. And, you know, we've talked about then aspen and dwarf willow. When did the pine forest enter the scene? And maybe where are they on this alpine, subalpine landscape?
Okay, so now for working into pine forest, you're talking about the subalpine below tree line, and that would be where the primary conifer forests are in the subalpine, all the way to the next layer down, which is called the montane. Where I work primarily is the conifers, the pines, the white bark pines specifically, right at tree line. So whenever I went up to the alpine and I'm collecting in the alpine, I had to come back down through these magnificent white bark pine forests. And these trees are old, craggy trees, like you might see on a postcard, with big jagged branches. They're five needle pines. They can be 1,000 years old. There's not a lot of understory. They're open forests and they're beautiful. And I really was ignoring them and the mycology of them as I would come down to process my alpine fungi. And then I spotted a mycorrhizal fungus in the white bark pine forest. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to have to see what's here. Because I really like those pure forests. Pure aspen, pure white bark pine, pure willow. When I go to the East Coast or the West Coast, where the trees are all mixed up together,
right,
it just boggles my mind. I cannot handle it. I cannot handle it. It's too much.
And do you think doing then field research in forests like that lends itself to making maybe more definitive conclusions about who is located where and why, because you're controlling that one big host variable?
Bingo. Absolutely right. Yes. Those simple systems, if it's only white bark pine or aspen, if you find a mycorrhizal fungus, that's associated with the forest, the tree that you're in. So for me, this was before molecular techniques, looking at some of these, right, and you couldn't figure out what was necessarily connected to what, although I started digging mycorrhizae later on. But just with the mushrooms, all you had to do was find the mushrooms and you knew what it was mycorrhiza was. So simple systems can really elucidate a lot. And where are those mushrooms within the forest? Are they on the edges where there's more sunlight? Are they with little stands of the younger trees? Are they only with the older trees? You can really pick out patterns if you just wander around and think about what's going on in the forest.
A pure forest can be kind of its own field petri dish, if you will, this controlled environment where you can start making a little bit more insight into what's going on at the fungal level. And I guess, what is the ectomycorrhizal landscape there? Because out where I live in Marin County, California, Northern California, and obviously we have pretty massive coastal pine stands. And so I think of the players that I'm used to, the Amanita muscaria, the Boletus edulis, but in those subalpine, you know, right at the tree line, white bark pine forests, what is the ectomycorrhizal scene like? How diverse and who are some of the players in there?
Yeah, so the white bark pine forests are, they became fascinating too. Every forest, I've almost never found a pure forest that I didn't like. Mixed right. forest, that's something else, but pure forest. For Amanitas, we've only found one, and that's a new species that I've named called Amanita alpinicola, because it's with the white bark pine and it's close to the alpine. It's not quite in it. But that's the only one, and it appears to be specific for white bark pine. We're not totally sure yet. It's been found with white bark pine in Montana, Wyoming, and I think out west, someone has found it. I'm trying to think. if it was Oregon or Washington, in the whitebark pine there. So it's a very unique Amanita. I've also found Croagomphus. They're called pine spikes. They have a round, shiny cap, and then they taper all the way down, and they look like a pine spike. They have decurrent gills, black spores. But the Croagomphus that we find in whitebark pine doesn't open up. It does not, the cap doesn't open and reveal the gills. It stays shut, and it's developed kind of an odor, and it's in the process of evolving probably to a underground or what's called a hypogeous habit. And it can't get its spores out by wind, so it's going to rely on small mammals or insects to get its spores around. So we found some really unique things. Just a few Russulas, not many Lactaria species. Only, I think we're only up to about 50 species. The alpine, we have maybe 200 so far. Douglas fir is reported to have 5,000 different species of ectomycorrhizal fungi. White bark, we're at about 50 species. So it seems to be pretty limited, although we're not, you know, people are doing the underground molecular part to see what's there, but we're not gaining that many species doing that.
Well, and in reading your work, it does sound like there can be challenges with colder environments that may not lend themselves to vast fruitings, that you may not actually be able to see necessarily all the ectomycorrhizal players. I mean, that's always a problem with field work, is the thing you're looking for, or is the true picture of the diversity going to show itself above ground? But it sounds like maybe that there's its own unique challenge there in the whitebark pine forest as well.
It's really unique. Yes, it can be really dry. And since there's not a lot of understory and it's very open, if you have a year where there's no rain, you won't find any of the fungi. And if there's a little rain, you really have to hunt. When I take my graduate students up there, I try to get them all excited that if we find a mushroom, we're going to be really excited. If we find 10 mushrooms, we are super excited, because it can be pretty discouraging and pretty difficult looking around some of those habitats where it's dry, and if the conditions aren't right, you're just not going to find them. So I try to prime them for, we're not going to load a basket up, but we'll be excited about what we find, because it'll be really, really unique.
I think all of us need to take that to heart to some extent. Even when you find just one mushroom, it's an exciting occasion worthy of celebration. And with that in mind, this kind of seemingly less diverse picture of ectomycorrhizal fungi, but when did you start exploring this idea of whitebark pine forest resiliency and ectomycorrhizal diversity or networks being somehow interlinked?
Yeah, like I mentioned, when I kept coming down from the alpine, I'd go through those whitebark pine forests. But then at one point, I realized that these whitebark pine forests, these five-needle pines, were really important for in terms of conservation. I started learning that their populations were declining. White pine blister rust, mountain pine beetles were decimating these beautiful old whitebark pine forests. And then I started noticing trees that had red needles and going through what are called ghost forests. And the ghost forests are where all of the trees are dead, the needles have dropped, but the trunk and the branches stay. So it's a beautiful old shiny gray ghost-like tree, one after the other after the other. So these are dead whitebark pine trees, and you're walking through this ghost forest. And I started asking questions, what's going on? Why are they dying? I found out, and then started thinking about, well, they must need certain mycorrhizal fungi to survive. Pines in nature need mycorrhizal fungi to survive. So I wanted to know, which ones were there? What were the native fungi that are supporting these forests? And were they diverse or were they not diverse?
So that leads you into this whole question of exploring those systematics. And I think you're pretty clear in your research about your focus on, you know, that ecological question of who's where, you know, but in your mind, is there any application? I think you just laid out really well the threats that white bark pine forests face. In your mind, is there an applied application where you could cultivate some of these native ectomycorrhizal communities, or are we still a little too far away from that?
Well, what we started to do is first we cataloged the mycorrhizal fungi, and then we looked to see which ones of those could we grow in culture, which right. ones could we either use the spores or the mycelium, and actually use these to inoculate young white bark pine seedlings. Because the forests were dying in great numbers, there's a whole movement to replant rust-resistant seedlings on the landscape. And they're growing them in a few different nurseries by the hundreds. And the Forest Service and a lot of other agencies are involved planting, well, by now, thousands across the landscape. So I began to wonder, would it be helpful to add the mycorrhizal fungi to those nursery seedlings to help them establish where they were going to be planted? Because a lot of these were planted on burns. White bark pine seems to do very well on burned areas.
Interesting.
But the burned areas, a lot of times, would burn out the mycorrhizal fungi, so right. they won't be there. So could we jumpstart the process by inoculating the seedlings? So a lot of my research has been involved with that. We're doing long-term studies right now. It does look like it helps, but the question is, how much does it help? Is it worth it for all the trouble? But my main thing was, we want to keep it to be native mycorrhizal fungi and not something you buy commercially. They're sensitive systems. You don't want to bring in any alien fungi.
No, you generally want to keep the alien fungi away. But no, that is one theme I'm hearing from so many people, whether it be some kind of land enhancement, micro-remediation, some kind of project like this where you're trying to inoculate seedlings, how important it is to pull from the native populations of fungi there to keep those systems healthy and avoid, you know, some unforeseen consequence that kind of cascades throughout the ecology there. Well, then the other question is, and you hinted before that you've spoken with researchers in Austria and around the world, you know, how do your findings then of kind of a lifetime of research of alpine and subalpine forests and their mycorrhizal fungi ecosystems, do we see these alpine fungi in other alpine environments around the globe?
For the alpine fungi, are also found in the Arctic, another cold climate, in the Alps of Austria, in Finland, in Norway, Alaska, all of those cold climates, you find the same fungi that you find, say, down in Colorado, even close to New Mexico. So the alpine fungi get around, and they're actually called the Arctic alpine fungi.
And then the next question is, I don't know if you've looked at that kind of biogeography at all or that evolutionary history, but then how would they, all of these fungi, be able to go from Arctic alpine region to Arctic alpine region? How did they get there?
Well, we have a lot of hypotheses. And I mean, one of them, we think that, just to make it short, glaciation may come into play. And so if you have glaciation pushing cold down to lower latitudes, then they may push that cold ahead of them. And then you've got mushrooms at a lower latitude, and then as the glaciers retreat, those cold-loving mushrooms retreat back to the tops of the mountains. That's one hypothesis. And can the mushroom spread the spores that far? That's another possibility.
Right.
I remember collecting in a high elevation in Colorado, I think it was Loveland Pass, and finding this unique tiny little mushroom. It just so happened I got on a plane in Denver and flew to Greenland, and I picked up that same tiny little mushroom after I landed. And I thought, my gosh, why'd I pay for a plane ticket, right? It's the same in both places. But it makes a point. I mean, those mushrooms that are on those high tops, mountaintops in Colorado and Montana, They're not found in the subalpine. They're not found out in the plains. They're not found in any of those other places. But if you go to another cold climate thousands of miles away, that's where you'll find them again. So it's a biogeographic pattern. And for the white bark pine, they are restricted to their range in Western North America. And a lot of the fungi I find with them are probably not going to be found anywhere else except for maybe the also called the white pine. But it's going to be much more restricted, much more endemic. So patterns are different across these forests.
But patterns emerge and they lead to all these incredible questions that I'm sure will take many, many careers of research for people to tease out what may be the truth behind these hypotheses and what that tells us. Are there any endemic mushrooms then, or native mushrooms, obviously endemic meaning only found there, or native mushrooms in these alpine and subalpine regions of the Rockies that hold a special place in your heart? You know, maybe just one or two that you really love from these regions that we may have never even heard of.
One I really like is Arhinia or Arhinia oriscalpium. It's 3 millimeters high by 2 millimeters wide. It looks like a little spoon. It has maybe a millimeter stem and then a spoon on the top. And it has two or three gills inside that spoon.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And that's it. It's a true alpine fungus. And whenever I find that mushroom, I get really excited, first of all, because it's small. How the heck did you even
find it? How did you see it? Yeah.
Yeah, right. How did you find it? And I've found it in the high elevations in Colorado and also in Greenland and several other of the Arctic places. So it's only found in those special habitats. It's not found anywhere else. It's a really unique, I guess we'll say, cute little mushroom.
Cute little mushroom. I'm going to dub a common name, the millimeter Arctic spoon fungi.
Yes.
Add that one to the list of mushrooms that I hope to see one day. Fascinating. And then maybe a favorite edible from this region as well. You know, maybe a favorite edible mycorrhizal fungi that we might not immediately think of.
Well, I like a lot of the usuals. And I like Dentinum repandum, the tooth fungus, just because it has a unique flavor. Actually, Horicium coralloides is rather nice. It's the, you could call it the branched bear's head. Bear's heads are usually just a big pom-pom. The ones I'm talking about are branched, and then the teeth come out along the branches. And you find it down in the riparian on aspen and cottonwood. That one's pretty good. I have a harder time eating some of those now. I just like to photograph them and watch them, and it's harder for me to, if there's just a few, it's harder for me to pick them.
Yes. I mean, at some point you become so connected with them, you don't actually want to take them out of their environment, I could imagine. Well, and then, you know, you've written some great field guides for Colorado and the Rocky Mountain region. Without going through an exhaustive list, it is a field guide. If you live in that area, everyone should probably own their field guides. What was that process like for you? Why did you decide to get into that kind of general taxonomy and writing a field guide? And then what was it actually like to put together a comprehensive list like that?
Well, the one that we put together was called The Essential Guide to Rocky Mountain Mushrooms by Habitat.
Yes.
So that's totally different from most of the mushrooms guides. And it was a little, it's unusual, but it's a little awkward to write just because it's so different. You're not putting all the Amanitas in one place. You're not putting all the Russulas in one place. You're saying, okay, what forest are you in? Are you in an aspen forest and you've found Amanita? Here's what it is. If you're in the alpine and you found an Amanita, here's what it is. So first you go to the habitat, and most of those habitats, with a couple notable exceptions, are pure forests or pure habitats. And then you can see what's there. There's starts with, well, finishes with the alpine going backwards, but there's some alpine fungi in one group. And actually, we have a group of burn fungi. If you're out on a burn, what fungi do you find on the burn? A lot of those are hard to identify with a regular mushroom book. Right. But if you have them all together in one habitat, it makes it a lot easier. And then we have the snowbank mushrooms, which come out in the spring, and they're at high elevations. The snow is almost melted, except for certain big snowbanks, and they fruit around those snowbanks. So we have a section on the snowbank fungi in there, and then we go down to conifer forests and aspen forests all the way down to the prairie. So it's by habitat, which is really different.
Well, and I love that idea because it seems so common sense. You know, a lot of times that's how you're kind of initially filtering what mushrooms, when you look through a guidebook, like for me, it's Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast. I look through what I think it might be, you know, some blend of visual, maybe I have an inkling. And almost right away, you go to the habitat part to make sure that, you know, the live oak or wherever you are was actually the right habitat. So of course, that would make sense to organize a book by habitat. And then how many years did it take to put that kind of thing together? I'm always curious about that because you get these books and we don't always understand the amount of work that happened to even capture the fungi, describe them. I know sometimes you're going back to primary sources to try to pull information. So what was that process like?
Well, I had two co-authors, Vera Evenson and Michael Kuo, on that. And Vera Evenson is a curator of the Sam Mitchell Fungal Herbarium in Denver. And Michael Kuo runs that wonderful website, Mushroom Expert. And we pooled resources on this. So we had a lot of background information and we divvied it up. I picked certain habitats. They picked certain habitats. We divided out the information. It's really, I would say, a lot of work to get to the point where you're ready to decide which mushrooms you want to put in there. And then over that process, it was maybe 2 years that we actually put the book together, each of us writing different sections, writing about the habitat, deciding what mushrooms we wanted to put in each habitat, and then putting the book together. We really found that we wish the book could be 1,000 pages. They limited us in terms of the number of species that we could add. So we could give a flavor of each of the habitats. It's more an ecology book as much as a mushroom identification book. Those guys were fun to work with.
Well, and between the three of you, I mean, the compendium of mushroom knowledge that would be possible would be nigh inexhaustible. So I'm surprised that you were able to limit it at all. But yes, as we've been talking through all of your work, it's very ecology based. And as I've learned more and more about mycology, having a greater understanding of ecology and the interactions that go on there is pretty essential. So a really smart theme to base a mushroom identification book around. Now, we've talked a lot about ectomycorrhizal fungi. So just in general, whether it be, you know, the subalpine, the alpine, or just ectomycorrhizal fungi in any forest, for you, what do you think the future of that research is? I mean, are we still on that question? I guess what I'm asking is, are we still on that question of who is where and why? Or what do you see as the future of ectomycorrhizal research?
I mean, that's a good starting point. And I may be stuck there because I'm looking at the cottonwood forest next. But also, people started with mycorrhizal research looking at the physiology of what was going on between plants and a particular fungi. And then they moved into ecology, which is what I'm doing. And then phylogeny is next. And a lot of my graduate students have worked on the phylogeny of particular mycorrhizal fungi in particular systems. So that's the whole molecular era coming in. I suspect now, I mean, we're moving on to, you can do big molecular probes. Tom Brunn's probably talked about this, and just probe the soil and analyze it, run it through the crank and find out what's there. And you don't have to wait for those fruiting bodies to come up. Takes all the fun out of it, but you know, you can do it efficiently. And I suspect that Coming next is going to be some of the genomics and metabolomics. They're at Duke. They're working on mycorrhizal fungi and what's actually going on between the fungus and the tree, and certain parts of the genome might light up when they do some of these processes. So there's a lot yet to do. We still don't know what's where, though. We still have to start with that.
That is going to be an everlasting question, and it's going to take Dr. Cripps going to each and every pure forest to start mapping that out. Well, you hinted at it, and that was one of my questions, is what then is directly in the future for you? And you said cottonwoods, but maybe what's in the future for you, and then expanding outward, some of your graduate students there at Montana?
Well, right now, I've been working in cottonwood forests, just kind of handy. I have one right down from the house here. So whenever I have a minute, I run down there and I'm gathering information on the cottonwood forest. I'm also interested in expanding the alpine systematic work. So we've covered quite a few, my graduate students have covered the phylogenetics of Russula, Lactarius. Todd covered Lactaria. We've done Ammonida. And now I'm working on, with a lot of the Europeans who work in Arctic and Alpine systems, on a lot of the other genera in the Alpine, and that would be the phylogenetics of those. So since I don't do molecular work myself, I have to hook up with somebody who has a lab to do that. So hopefully someday we put that all together into a book on Alpine fungi. Mycorrhizal first, and then the saprophytes maybe after that. Branch out a little.
Yeah, branch out a little bit, but it'll be interesting in that branching theme to see maybe where different species in different areas have branched out. Even if they seem identical in these Arctic alpine environments, maybe there is some speciation going on. That'll be really, really interesting to see. Well, where can people find you and find your work, Dr. Cripps? Because I think anybody listening is probably incredibly fascinated like I am. We all want to dig in and learn more. So where can people find you, connect with you, and find out more about your work?
Probably the easiest way is to go to Montana State University website and then go to the Department of Plant Sciences and Plant Pathology. And on that website, it'll say faculty, and you can just scroll down to me. And there's quite a few of my publications listed on that website. So that's probably a good way to start.
And I have to know, as someone who came from, as you said, a feral background, almost living in the mountains, what has it been like to be at the beating heart of a university, be teaching and inspiring students? What has that done to change your whole life and even these relationships with these organisms? What has that been like to become a teacher and kind of at the center of university academic society?
Yeah, that was a long pull from the woods to academics. And at first it was in grad school, I suddenly realized I liked to teach. And after not being verbal for a couple of decades, it was an absolute surprise. I just came to learn the names of the mushrooms. And in order to earn our keep, we were teaching assistants in biology. So the first thing you had to do is you had three biology courses with 75 students each, and you were going to teach them. And so there was no choice. And I got up in front of the class, and words did not come that easily then. It was a long process, and I had to learn what a computer was. That was rather a surprise, and into statistics and all of that. So it was a long process, but you know, the academic part of it, the learning, the new knowledge, the learning about mushrooms, being interconnected with people that know a lot, know so much more than you, and having access to all the literature, that was exciting. That was exciting. It was enough to keep me going. I still do field work. I still go out into the woods all summer. I take my students. I go out there. So I'm still in the woods 3 to 4 months a year, and academics for the rest of it, and just piling up that information. So it was a long haul. It was it was quite a transition, but I made it through there, and we'll see if I end up going back to the woods.
I know, we started the interview, you said you're in your home office, and now I have to wonder, is she out in a cabin still in the middle of the woods? But it sounds like you found a happy balance between spending enough time in the woods and still being integrated with this community, all based around these organisms you love. I mean, it sounds like a really transformative process, as I imagine it must be.
Yes, and I got lucky. I've got a good job, and I can see the mountains right from my office here. So
never too far away.
Nope, they're 10 minutes away.
Of course. Well, to wrap things up then, I'll ask the three questions I like to ask all my guests. And actually, the first one we've kind of covered. I've been too curious not to ask you for some great mushrooms there in the Arctic Alpine, but just another mushroom that you love and why, and it doesn't have to be like the most favorite or one you even like to eat, you know, but just a mushroom that you love and why you want to share with us.
I might say what was once called Psoilus sibiricus. Now it's called Psoilus americanus. Mm. And that's a slippery jack, the Psoilus. So they're small boletes, slimy on top, pores underneath. But Psoilus sibiricus is really common in white bark pine forests. And there's some other Psoilus species there as well. But Psoilus sibiricus seems to be in all the white bark pine forests that we've found. And it grows well in culture. We got to play with it in the lab, put it on seedlings, do a lot of different experiments with it. And I think that, along with two other Psoilus species, is going to be really important with white bark pine restoration. There's Psoilus alpinus and Psoilus discolor. Psoilus alpinus is only found with white bark pine. Psoilus discolor with five needle pines, very specific. You know, if we lose the white bark pine forest, there are a couple Psoilus there we may lose as well. So one of those, Psoilus subalpinus, is listed on the conservation list. Lose the tree, lose the mushroom. Yeah. You want to put that ecosystem back together, you need the parts.
Absolutely. It's never going to be the same if you lose two key players. And I was curious about how your research in some of these mushrooms that seem to be intimately linked with conservation and very unique in terms of their environment, how that blended with efforts like the efforts to get certain fungi red listed and create conservation lists with the Fungal Diversity Survey. And it sounds like you're very much kind of current with those efforts and trying to make sure these mushrooms, these unique mushrooms that you study, are protected.
Yes, and some of that's due to Todd Osmundson, who was my first graduate student, and he's very involved with conservation. Periodically, he'll just shoot me an email and say, what do we need to say? What's worthy of conservation? And so I can say, Psoilus subalpinus, and Todd does all the work on it. So
that's the beauty of grad students.
Yes, that's right.
Well, and then a big kind of more general question, might be all encompassing, but you know, what has this relationship you've developed with mushrooms and fungi given to you? And maybe that's like new perspectives on how to interpret the world, maybe a new sense of spirituality, or maybe just loving those mountains you love even that much more. But what has a relationship with fungi and mushrooms given to you?
I would say there's definitely a mycelial thread that runs through my life. I used to think it was in parts, but I see that it's bound by, like you say, first living with the mushrooms and then studying them. First as an amateur, gathering free food, and then studying those mushrooms. I think that started to give direction to my life. Not that wandering around the woods is all bad. There's a lot to be learned. But they started to direct me into deeper and deeper questions of what's going on for research. So the mushrooms were really leading the way. I just wanted to know their names. And the next thing I know, I'm in grad school. And like you say, the next thing I know, I'm doing research and teaching grad students. It's all the mushrooms pulling me. And they've allowed me opportunity not only to do research, but travel, and travel with purpose, not just as a tourist to look around, but when I travel, there is no such thing as a vacation without fungi or mushrooms. It's always to some place to see what's there. My husband tried to get me to the beach one time, but you know, there are marine fungi and you can collect them in the foam on the beach and look at the spores under the microscope. So they're everywhere. Interaction with colleagues all over the world. I have a whole group of international colleagues from all these different Arctic and Alpine countries. We have a meeting every 4 years. It's called the International Symposium on Arctic and Alpine Mycology. We met once in Montana on the Beartooth Plateau. We've met in Finland, Arctic Norway, Greenland, Alaska, and all of these people like myself join up and we share experiences. So I would just say it's been pretty satisfying contributing to science, new science, new species, new knowledge. I can always go back to the woods.
Well, I think your story is one of the most powerful in how just following that mycelial thread with the passion and the hunger to learn more. And of course, there's kind of heaps of intellect and courage and everything else along the way to actually do that. But it's a story of how you can follow that thread and suddenly end up somewhere magnificent, so enriched. And so I think your story is like the perfect illustration of that. So I love that insight into what it's brought to you, what getting to know these organisms has done to change your life. And then the final question, again, is pretty general. The final question is, what are kind of the highest aspirations you see for our society as we start to learn more and more about fungi and mushrooms, their role in ecosystems? You know, what's your kind of best hope for how our cultures and societies will shift kind of based on that information and based on deepening our relationship with fungi?
Yeah, that's a large question.
Massive question.
I'm talking about envisioning the future of our society. I hope it's kind of a balance between conservation and science. And first of all, conservation of the natural world. E.O. Wilson has a really interesting book called Half Earth. I don't know if you've read it, but he has a blueprint for setting aside half of the earth as natural systems. And he's laid out where we can do that. So it's not pie in the sky. He was very realistic about saving half of the earth for conservation and for fungi and all the other organisms in those systems. So that's the conservation side of it. The other side is I'm hopeful that we can use science to develop hopefully green new technology and to overcome some of our problems. And fungi should figure large in that, I think. Just something as simple as mushrooms or fungi as a replacement for meat. That's pretty simple.
Yeah.
As a alternative for some of our building materials, such as cement and other things that produce greenhouse gases. And they're making mycelial bricks these days and as actual building blocks for products. And you can make a lot of things out of fungal mycelium that are biodegradable. Biodegradable. I have a contest with my students at the end of the class. What can we make? And they talk about surfboards. Wow, they would float. And skateboards and all different kinds of things. Insulation. It's fireproof. The products are endless that you could make out of fungi. Right now, it's very realistic that they are the new the alternative for styrofoam.
Yeah. There are
companies doing that and companies using it because styrofoam packing is going to sit in the landfill forever. But fungal mycelium as an alternative biodegrades. There's a plastic-eating fungus that has potential. So I think fungi need to figure pretty large in the technology side of our future.
You know, my fungal excitement from this conversation was probably at a 10 out of 10, and I think we just kicked it into an 11 when you just laid out the world made of mycelium that you see as our future. And I'm not surprised you had some great insights. You know, it's often said that people who kind of go on these long journeys for part of their life, even in seclusion, kind of come back with all of this inner knowledge and new insights and perspectives. So I'm not surprised you just laid out a beautiful vision of the future. But Dr. Cripps, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing information about your research, sharing some of those big, deep insights, and sharing your story, which I'm absolutely in love with. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you for highlighting the fungi, the mushrooms. They rule.